So let me thank the organizers for inviting me to give this talk. It's actually related to Mike's talks of last week. Mike was telling us sort of a top-down approach to getting topological field theory, starting with discrete cobordism valued invariants and somehow exercising very abstract machinery to synthesize the invariants at higher codimension. And I'll be telling you an opposite approach, which is bottom up, how to give microscopic descriptions on the surface to create some material which induces the properties of a particular TQFT. The other distinction from last week is the letter Q. This will be the quantized version rather than the classical version. So I'll sort of implicitly have integrated out all the fields that Mike was telling you how to construct. So, you know, I was educated, and a lot of people in my generation in topology were educated by Bill Thurston to think of geometry as arising microscopically. You know, you had these little pieces of material that were like order 7, valence 7 vertices, or negatively curved tissue paper, and then you sort of figured out, you know, what you could make of it, and you found out you could make high genus surfaces but not tori and things like that. So I think of the present work I'm engaged in as sort of a reversion to that past. We're thinking of TQFTs not so much in terms, I mean, eventually we're interested in their global properties, what the ground state degeneracies are, what the excitations are, what braiding and fusion relations are. But to begin with, we're thinking of it as a completely local issue. It's some kind of discrete lattice model, say, and a local Hamiltonian that's describing all the physics. That's sort of analogous to the curvature tensor, which gives you a hyperbolic metric. And then just as the hyperbolic metric preordains what's going to happen globally, so does this local Hamiltonian preordain, you know, what kind of particle physics this little bit of two-dimensional material will support. So I decided to present this talk. This is quite a strain for me, by the way, trying to use a laptop during a lecture. So we'll just see if it works. I may collapse from the nervous stress. People who know me will understand this. but we have it turned on. So this is probably relevant to the middle of the talk, but I wanted to get it out of the way at the beginning. It's a little computer game, which was written by an undergraduate at Harvard, very talented guy, Dimitar Jetov. And it illustrates the ergodicity of some perfect matchings of the plane under some local moves. So what this has to do with a two-dimensional quantum media which supports a TQFT should become clear as we go. But let me just present this as a game. I hope you can see it. What's written in red are, we call it a crystal. It's in graph theory, it'd be called a perfect matching. Every vertex of this triangular lattice sees one red edge or red bond. So you can think of the red lines in the picture as being perfect, as matching the vertices. Every vertex is bound to every other, bound to some other vertex by a red edge. So if you count 1/6 of the edges are red. Oops. See, this is the kind of thing I was, that worked, you just sort of stroke it. Yeah. There are also blue bonds in the picture, and something that might be confusing if you're in the back of the room is most of the blue bonds actually lie on top of red bonds. So those are kind of double bonds, and they should be interpreted as little loops, smallest scale circles, even though they don't actually open up. but you can think of the red ones as maybe slightly above the plane, the blue ones as slightly below the plane, bent. So think of those as bigons, circles of length 2. And now if you look carefully, you'll see some other circles of a longer length. I hope you can see, like there's a circle of length 8 right above my finger. It looks like a bow tie. Oh, there's a stick. There's a loop of length 8. And here's a loop of, I don't know, length about 16 or something. Here's quite a long loop. Anyway, there's another one. I think there are 5 loops that aren't bigons in the picture. And all the dots represent possible combinatorial moves. And I can click on one of these dots to create a move. So, for instance, if I click right there, the thing of length 8 becomes something of length 10. Okay. And if I click on that dot, it goes back to the way it was. So what most of the moves that you see in the picture, most of the available moves, I'll make one more, are of the form, we call them type 1 moves. What they do is they represent topologically capturing a small circle and adding it to a large circle. So topologically, you have some fairly long circle, and you have a bigon. And if you click on the dot that's present in between the two, what it does is it connects the small circle, the bigon, to the larger circle like that. So I'll go double-click on this and see if that happens. So we captured a small circle, and if you click on it again, you release the small circle. And there's some numerical factor associated with this, a weight, like a Gibbs weight, but that's not visible in the computer game. There's one other type of move visible here, and that's when the dot occurs on a red edge. See, these blue edges in the picture should be thought of as occupation. There's some kind of ground state that's occupied, that whose occupation determines a blue dimerization of the plane, or a blue perfect matching. And if you click on that red dot, what that's telling you to do, it's telling you to do what's called a plaquette flip, which is a double move out of the ground state manifold and back into the ground state manifold, where this occupied edge is released and the particle that's occupying it moves there. That's an excitation. And then it's unexcited then by moving this particle over to this edge. So the net effect is a double motion. These two edges of the rhombus become unoccupied, and the two black edges of the rhombus then become occupied. And now the interesting thing is, if the diagonal of the rhombus is red, then the loop that's made, you notice all these loops have alternating color. They go blue, red, blue, red, blue, red. If you look at the alternating loop after this plaquette flip, it has the same isotopic class that it had before. And that's a function of the fact that the diagonal is red, and we're drawing the loops by alternating red and blue. So let me try to click on one of those points on a, and let's just see how it changes by isotopy. Oops, the dots are pretty small. There. Okay. Now, before I turn the game off, there's one last point I want to make about it. I hope you can see this picture on the side. I've sort of told you about dots that are present. There's an interesting dot that's not present, and that is if you have two longish loops and they come near each other, you might think there should be a dot present that would allow this to happen. And we particularly don't want that to happen because this creates a very strong equivalence relation on loops, which is associated to Z2 gauge theory. It's actually associated to the level one SU2 theory or the level two U1 theory. And it gives some kind of TQFT, but it's a very small TQFT with a small number of particles and abelian statistics. We want to avoid this one so we don't have that move.
So does the game start with only with all the blues on all the
reds? Yeah, that's true. The game starts with all the blues on all the reds, and it seems to be an empirical fact playing this game that the moves, oh, there's one other move, which is there's a crystal breaking move. If you go over to the side here where there are no large loops and you click on any one of these, what happens is what's called a ring exchange occurs. That is, four particles shift 1/8 turn each and form a, in this game, oops. And form a ring, okay? That's actually not so important to move. You only have to do those rarely. But those are the only moves that can fracture the red crystal. If you do one of those, that's actually enough, then it can. These moves will have, I'll come to this, will have some underlying physical basis, or they can just be postulated mathematically. But an important combinatorial fact is that they're ergodic, that if you take any system of loops, you can get to any other system of loops by these three moves and their inverses.
Yeah. The other two moves involve two blue rings. This one involves four.
That's right. That's right. And actually, with respect to some microscopic models, that might be regarded as a defect because it requires some correlated motion of four electrons. So that model I'll actually show, the background red crystal actually has some defects in it, so that there are certain rhombi that have two red edges, and then there'll be only a two-particle move that breaks the crystal. It's actually an interesting little combinatorial fact that if you take the triangular lattice and you look for a red dimerization without any rhombi that have opposite sides red, then you're forced into this crystal. It's unique. But I was going to say there's an ergodicity fact that you can get from any configuration of loops to any other configuration of loops by this move. And we know this to be true in the sense that a chess player knows that he has a one game if he's up a queen. And we have computer evidence that this is true. But it might be undecidable, actually. These combinatorial things are not so easy. So we don't have a mathematical proof. Now, so let me put this to rest, see if this works. Yeah, oh, please wait. Okay. And now I know that physicists are antsy at this point. Oh, could someone push the off button on that? Because I know in physics that thanks. Is that one? I think that might. Do you think that might overheat it or catch the room on fire? Maybe. I think there's a button on the top that says on. Oh, thanks. So a physics talk should begin by writing down a Hamiltonian. So there we are. This is supposed to make the physicists in the audience relax to see something like this. I should say that everything I'll be talking about is joint work with Chet Nayak and Kirill Stengel. This is, if you're familiar with these kinds of things, you'll probably recognize the notation. It's just to show sort of the local form of the physics that we put on these two-dimensional systems in order to get anions to come out. I'll just go through, I wrote underneath in red sort of what the terms do. This will be an occupancy model where particles lie on the edges, not the vertices of the triangular lattice. So some people would use the word kagome lattice at this point. That's the, it's not actually a lattice, it's the union of three lattices that arise by considering the centers of the edges of the triangular lattice. And if it's your sort of linguistic preference to say that particles live on sites rather than bonds, then you'd say that they lived on the vertices of the Kagame lattice. But I won't use that language. I'll say they live on the edges or the bonds of the triangular lattice. So n is the number operator. And the first u infinity is just some large constant, which if these are bosons, possibly two might occupy the same site. And that ni squared creates a huge penalty to that if the coefficient in front is large. So the first term just requires single occupancy. And then if you put in sort of 1/6 fill, which I'm doing, then single occupancy and 1/6 fill plus some kind of Coulomb repulsion will spread them out to give you a dimer covering. And the second term is a penalty for dimer collision. If I and J are edges, and that little bracket, I bracket J equals 1, means they intersect in one point. So they're not really apart like dimers should be, but they share. So some vertex has two occupied edges touching it. Then there's some energy penalty, capital U. The next term is a pointwise term, again, and that's an on-site potential. The ith edge has some potential delta I, and this will be connected with the color coding. The red edges might have a different on-site potential for some reason than the black edges. And finally, there's these plaquette flip terms, which I learned about from a paper of Kivelson and Roxar. I think they're often called Kivelson-Roxar terms, which gives some kind of potential cost to the particles being close to each other, as close as they can be without a dimer collision, which is occupying opposite sides of a rhombus. And the tricky thing will be that the potential cost will involve some color information about the rhombus. So if they're on a black-red opposite edge, there might be a different constant of potential cost there than if they're on black-black edges. So the notation is V, the color of I, the color of J. Depends on the edges enter through their coloring. And Ni and J just kicks in when they're both occupied. So these are all the potential terms on the top. And the last thing is, in sort of second quantized notation, is the hopping. Oh, I left off a letter, and I don't have the pen with me. There should have been CI dagger CJ, CJ dagger CI. I just didn't write it. So that's the hopping term from site I to J and back again. So a particle is annihilated at J and created at I, with some amplitude Tij. And these will only occur when the sites are very close to each other, they share, where the edges share a vertex, and only across 60 degrees. So it's sort of the smallest moves possible on the triangular lattice. And I'll tell you, well, actually there are four models that we've been playing with, and two of them are bosonic, and two of them are spinless fermions. So the one I'll explain in detail is a bosonic model. Those are positive. And I'm sorry. You're right. This should be a minus sign, too. The hopping term should be minus. U and all these other U's. Yeah, all these other U's are positive, and I want this term to contribute with a negative sign. So. Well, it could be, but usually,
well,
yeah, it's actually a typing error. It's not. I wasn't thinking of Tij as negative. So I should say these Hamiltonians only make the physicists relax if the signs are all correct. Otherwise, they excite them. So, okay, I can put this up again when it becomes relevant. Oops. I was warned against raising that too high. So the so the basic idea of the local description, that local descriptions that we'll be talking about, is kind of captured by the phrase de-isotopy. So let me explain what this is, and then come back to the lattice models. So right now, just think of everything in the smooth world. And suppose you have a surface. It might have a boundary, or it might be closed. We can think about the, call it S, the set of one submanifolds. Sigma. So this, another word for this might be multi-loops. So let me just explain what I mean. I want to think in the surface of pictures like this. The pictures I draw do not necessarily have to be connected, therefore it might be misleading to call them a set of loops, because it might be three loops. That's what I'm calling a multi-loop. But I do not want curves to end, at least not in the interior of the surface. I don't want curves to cross. I don't want curves to fork. Okay, so this is what I mean by a one-dimensional submanifold or a multi-loop. And I want to think of the Hilbert space, well, think of the vector space, which is form a linear combinations of multi-loops. So we just linearize. And I actually prefer to think, I think it's closer to the underlying physics, I like to think dually. So I like to think of the Hilbert, or the vector space of functions from this set to the complex numbers. But if you want to think in terms of amplitudes, think of the value of the function as just the complex amplitude for that classical configuration. And now, notice that as I put on linear constraints, I can capture some equivalence relations. For instance, I can add linear constraints which cut me down to not the functions on one manifolds, but the functions on bracket one manifolds, where this means isotopy classes. So how do I cut down to this? Well, I simply impose a linear constraint on this vector space, which is to say that the function value on two multi-loops are the same if the loops differ by a deformation. So this inclusion corresponds to a constraint, which can be written this way. The function on a picture, and I'll just draw a piece of the picture. This line maybe should be yellow. This is just a piece of the multi-loop. The function value will be the same if I take a piece of the picture and I bend it, because any isotopy can be made by a succession of small bends. So if I impose a universal relation like this, this is a local relation on this Hilbert space. If I impose this local relation, I restrict to the subspace. And now what I want to do is further restrict to a space which I'll write this way, and this is called the de-isotopy space. And this is slightly more complicated than the first case, because it can't be explained on the objects alone. You have to look at the coefficients as well. And what this says is this says that f of some small picture with an extra loop, f of a local picture with an extra small loop is equal to a scalar d times f of the original picture. And d will be a real number. Sorry for running these two formulas together. Well, we fix D once and for all. Yeah. So there'll be certain interesting values of D, and I'll discuss those right now. Let me point out that if I impose these two relations together, which I have by the time I get down to this subspace, that is, I've imposed isotopy and the D relation, then the value of any loop which bounds a disk is D. It doesn't have to be a small loop, because a large loop which bounds a disk up to isotopy is a small loop which bounds a disk, and then getting rid of it kicks in a multiplicative factor of D. Now, these spaces are what are called extensively degenerate. I mean, if you decide to put these on a lattice model, you'll find out they're all infinite dimensional. I mean, there are infinitely many, on a torus, for instance, there are infinitely many different isotopy classes. And there are certainly infinitely many isotopy classes that involve no trivial loops at all. So these become larger and larger as you refine the lattice scale. And you might ask whether these spaces have quotients, if you can add additional linear constraints, which make these finite dimensional and independent of the combinatorics. And the answer is yes, if D is special. So there's a theorem, if and only if D is 2 cosine pi over k plus 2 for k 1, 2, 3, etc., only for these values, does there exist a further local relation such that one, the quotient is non-trivial, or the constraint space is non-trivial. Not completely trivial. And two is a technical condition that a certain natural inner product is positive definite. Hermitian product. So this is an important physical condition. It means that you'll have a physical Hilbert space. So the values, oh, slide that right back up. The values that D can assume are D can be 1, the square root of 2, 1 plus the square root of 5 over 2, the square root of 3, the sequence of numbers which converges toward 2. And in each case, for these values of D, there is a quotient space, which I'll write, or a constraint space, which I'll write VD, where an additional relation is imposed, additional local relation, some Skein relation, and this becomes a Hilbert space, and it's finite dimensional. And these different special values of D all correspond to the SU2 a level K theory. So this is K equals 1, 2, 3, 4, and so on. And these are the TQFTs that these correspond to are actually not the fundamental theories, the chiral theories, SU2 level K, but there are certain quantum doubles of them, Grinfield doubles. So their dimensions are the square of what you're expecting. So in K equals 1, the dimension of the ground state degeneracy, the dimension of the Hilbert space on the 2 torus, these dimensions are 4, 9, 16, 25, and so on, the squares. They're the endomorphisms of those blocks.
But I'm trying to get oriented as to which conformal filter you're actually thinking about. Is it the minimal model, the concept model?
No. What you should be thinking of is you should be thinking of the SU. Start with thinking of the SU2 theory at level K, that is K plus 1 particles, and now think of its endomorphism algebra. So that's matrices, K plus 1 by K plus 1. And that's what these are related to. Now, there's a technical point that in order to specify a theory, you have to give more than the level. You also have to choose a root of unity. And the corresponding roots of unities here may lead to undoubled theory that's singular. The S matrix will be degenerate. These theories all have non-singular S matrices. But the process of doubling them can repair that defect. So these theories, in some cases, for instance, in the level 2 case, this is exactly the endomorphisms of the most familiar undoubled level 2 theory. In the level 1 case, the theory is singular, and this is a non-trivial double. But the level 1 case is something that's quite familiar already in the solid-state physics literature. This is the Z2 gauge theory, the deconfined Higgs phase of the Z2 gauge theory that people like Fisher and Senthal write about. So I think all this will become clearer if I tell you what the local relations are. So I said there, here I gave local relations that took you from functions on one manifolds to functions on isotopy classes. Then I did the same thing. I added another local relation, which told you that the circle value was D. These are small relations. Now, when D equals 1, the admissible local relation, so the local relation that does not destroy the space entirely, any other relation could still be imposed, but it would give a zero-dimensional Hilbert space, which isn't physically interesting. You can't have a ground state in it. In D equals 1, the relation is simply that F of this picture equals F of this picture. So nothing could be simpler. This is the reconnection picture, okay? So this is what I said when I had the projection screen up. This is what I said I did not want to allow, because I want to, in general, avoid the simplest theory. When D equals 2, there's a 5-skein relation, which is, D equals square root of 2, K equals 2. There's this skein relation. So this is the first time we see a relation that can't be interpreted as some picture is equal to a scalar times some other picture. I mean, it's a linear relation on five pictures. One way of interpreting it is to put the first term of the relation on one side of the equation and put the other four on a different side. And then you can say what this tells you is that if you ever see three strands running parallel, you're allowed to simplify the picture and say this is actually a superposition of four other pictures in which no more than one strand gets through. So this kind of simplification rule tells you right away that if you impose a relation like this, you'll get a finite dimensional space on the surface of fixed genus. Because if you fix a triangulation on the surface, the multiplicity across any edge would not have to be more than one. Or two, not more than two. Because if you saw three strands going across an edge, you could make a simplification. But it's a rather non-trivial fact that other relations that you might impose, like if you change this to 1.5, that you'll kill the Hilbert space entirely. So that's a bit surprising. So let me just, in the simplest case, give an intuitive explanation for why this relation is so tightly coupled to D equals 1. This is four dimension on the torus. Yeah. On the torus, this is very simple. On the torus, the generators for the Hilbert space are simply the longitude, the meridian, the diagonal, all the bases, the basis for, or and then the empty picture, the empty circle, you know, the zero class. So in D equals 1, K equals 1, the Hilbert space on any surface is simply functions from the first homology of the surface with Z2 coefficients to C. So just to get a feel for why these might be tightly organized, just consider what would happen if you set D equal to, say, 1.1 instead of 1 and tried to maintain the same relation, okay? So that if you look at the function value of some picture that has an arc in it, by isotopy, it has to have the same function value as the arc deformed. And because of this local relation that allows you to reconnect, this has to have the same function value as this reconnected picture. But the reconnected picture is now the original picture up to isotopy plus a trivial circle. But the trivial circle, we agreed, has value 1.1, not 1. So this is equal to 1.1 times the original picture. But that says the original picture has to have value 0. So what is the combinatorics here? Well, this comes from, you know, the theory of C-star algebras. This, you know, we didn't discover these relations. We learned of their relevance, basically. These are the Jones-Wenzel projectors, which were written down in the late 80s. And they have, the number of terms is the Catalan number. It has to do with how many ways you should think of like a small disk in which this picture is drawn. And you see either 2 points or 4 points, or the next case would be 8 points on the boundary of the disk. And each term in the relation is a different arc pattern that pairs without crossing the two endpoints on the boundary. So the next one would have a 14-term relation. That would be what comes up at level 3. So the entry idea here is that we'll try to make TQFTs, for whatever our reasons, from the complex of one-dimensional manifolds on the surface. But then we have to have a way of making, you know, one-dimensional manifolds labeled or arise physically. You know, we need by occupation number or something like that. And that's where these dimer coverings will come in. So this might be, yeah, this is probably a good point to explain how dimers come in. So it's an old idea in solid state physics, going back at least 10 or 15 years to the Kivelson-Roxar paper, and maybe it goes back before then, I'm not sure, that if you have a background dimerization, so perfect matching dimerization, those are synonyms. So like the red thing I put up on the screen. And then you have another dimerization, which I'll call blue. Then you can take red union blue, and this becomes a one manifold. So that explains the pictures I started with. The alternating cycles of red and blue edges are simply the one-dimensional manifold that's made by concatenating the red dimers and the blue dimers. I mean, after all, a dimer is something whose boundary map is exactly bijective with the vertices. So if you have two of them, each vertex gets hit by two dimers, and that's the condition for being a manifold. Now, it requires a slight interpretation. If the two dimer, if a red and blue dimer occur identically, then you have to decide what you mean by this double edge. And that's what why I told you in the beginning, you should stretch your imagination to think of that as a small loop by bending one up and one down. But with that proviso, the union of two dimers is a one manifold. Now, at this moment, I can explain also why we took the triangular lattice. The reason was, when you construct manifolds this way, if you take the more standard choices for lattices, like the square lattice or the hexagonal lattice, these are bipartite lattices. And the result is that the dimers acquire a natural orientation, because a dimer will connect, you know, like in the square lattice, the odd parity to the even parity vertices, and you can make a universal convention, put an arrow from odd to even. And we would see that we would be really working with the complex of oriented loops when we started stacking dimers together, rather than the complex of loops. And it's very important that SU2 theory, if that's your target, that you start with loops that don't have any natural orientation. And in fact, I want to emphasize this point slightly, because this was something that disturbed me for a very long time when I was thinking about how to use microscopic physics to make interesting TQFTs, because I knew the interesting TQFTs were associated with non-abelian Lie groups. And, you know, I knew that the gauge theory for electromagnetism was U1. So there was always this worry in the back of my mind that you wouldn't be able to do anything interesting that would get you in SU2 theory, say, with electron degrees of freedom or something like that, that would, you know, that you'd have to do something physically unimplementable, like a weak force computer or something. But, you know, physics is full of different bridges and connections, and you don't always have to be walking on the most obvious bridge. And the connection between SU2 and dimers, which might be occupation by electrons or whatever, is simply this Rumer-Teller-Weil theorem, which goes back to the 50s. So what the Rumer-Teller-Weil theorem says is it says that the representation category of SU2, when you think of it as a tensor category, together with whatever natural structure it has, which is contraction of tensors and cyclic rotation of tensor products, that this is equivalent to unoriented planar arc diagrams. So, you know, for example, so in SU2, the fundamental representation is self-dual. So there'll be no arrows on endpoints. There'll be no plus and minus vertices. If I draw on the circle two dots, I'm thinking of the tensor square of the fundamental representation. And if I draw an arc in the disk, I'm thinking either as a morphism from zero products of the tensor representation to two, which would be the invariance. So this, under this isomorphism, this diagram corresponds to up, down, minus, down, up. This is the singlet. And many of you may know from physicists know representation theory well that if you take 2n copies of the fundamental representation, then the analogous of the singlet, the space of invariance, has dimension the nth Catalan number. And that simply, and that basis, that space of invariance is simply parametrized by all the different ways of pairing two endpoints without crossing the arcs. So there is this isomorphism between the SU2 representation theory and pictures and unoriented arc pictures. And if you want a good modern exposition of this, I'd say Greg Cooperberg's paper called Spiders, which is posted on the web, begins with a discussion of this story, and he goes on to compute the spiders. He calls these pictures, when they get more complicated, spiders, because if you go to SU3 or G2, the rank 2 Lie groups, which he works out in detail, then the representation theory is isomorphic not to unoriented arcs, but more complicated diagrams in the disk with arrows and vertices and labels up to certain equivalence relations. So this is a story which continues, but I only need the zeroth degree of the story. I'm just using the fact that there's a connection between the classical representation theory and pictures in the plane. And when you truncate the classical representation theory at a certain level, that means you truncate the pictures in the plane by a Jones-Wenzel projector. So if you want to study representation theory up to level 2,
so that's
you,
how
well, I don't know that language, but the correct, I mean, a correct statement is that if you look at the complex of unoriented one manifolds, modulo the Jones-Wenzel relation at a certain point, you get the physical Hilbert space on that surface associated to the TQFT that I just described to you, the Grenfell double of the SU2 theory at a given level.
And that's what you mean by truncating at level 10, imposes.
Well, that, yes, but it's also, but there's a commutative diagram. You get the same theory by truncating, by making the algebraic structure, the quantum group. You can make the quantum group by truncating at level k. You can take its quantum double and take its associated TQFT, and that will be isomorphic to this more naive kind of microscopic approach.
Which of the structures survives?
What structure survives? You mean in the tensor product?
They all survive. Becomes the fusion?
Yeah, yes. Yeah. I mean, you have to divide out by the negligible morphisms in the representation category. It's the usual. So it's probably time to just sort of show you the model and wrap up. So let me turn the projector on again. Hmm. So the plan is to make a very simple occupation model, which occupies some dimers, which we think of the blue dimers, together with a background dimerization, which are the red dimers. This gives some loops. And then we have to institute some dynamics, which implements the deisotopy relation and the and then implicitly the Jones-Wenzel relations. So I should have made a point of this. The microscopics are going to be designed to implement the deisotopy relation and not these giant Jones-Wenzel relations, which, you know, are basically hopeless to input locally. But the ansatz is that if you control the physics to implement deisotopy as the ground state of the Hamiltonian, then since that's extensively degenerate, the system won't really stop there. It will seek to relieve some of that degeneracy, and then the algebraic uniqueness, the fact that that there's only one local relation which can be further imposed, is supposed to guide the system toward the topological phase. So, finite dimensional.
Yeah.
Yes, that'll be like the n k plus 1 squared dimensional degeneracy on the torus. So, yeah, so the beginning picture, which was sort of on the computer display, is this. It's a lattice with this crystal. And then I mentioned that for these very simplest, well, in some ways the simplest model, we don't want to have this bow tie move, which is a correlated move of four electrons. That's outside the Hubbard model. That's what's called a ring exchange term. And we can write models with ring exchange terms, but it's kind of an interesting exercise to use the minimum input and try to write a purely Hubbard model. So what we do for that is we produce a defect periodic, you know, extensively. It doesn't have to be periodic, but occasionally in the lattice we say that the preferred red bonds have been rotated in this way. And what you should notice is that this creates a four-sided figure, a rhombus with two opposite red sides. And that means that there's an opportunity for a two-particle ring, which is can be created easily by Hubbard terms, which would take you from this site and this site to this site and this site. And then instead of two bigons, you'd have one quadrilateral born. And then once a quadrilateral exists, then a hexagon can be made by the move that captures this edge. The fundamental idea is to write down hopping rules. So with respect to the original Hamiltonian, there were these T's. How far can I write to the left? Can people still see this? Like that far? Okay. So, actually, I'll have to admit that we add a few more colors to the diagram. I was hoping to hide this. Near the singularity, there's some unusual hopping configurations. And what we would like to do is we'd like to have arrange that the potentials on all the bonds be such that when they're renormalized with respect to the hoppings, that they're equal. But the different bonds will live in slightly different environments, and some will have more hopping and some will have less hopping. So the different colors here actually correspond to how they have to be given an initial on-site potential, so that after renormalizing, they all agree up to second order. Because in our Hamiltonian, we don't want terms which prefer the particles to live on any particular bond. We want that to be kind of a democracy. We want only these pairwise terms, which give weight to different weights to different configurations according to how they occupy opposite sides of a rhombus. Well, no, not block spins. So if you so what we do is we expand, you know, the original Hamiltonian I wrote out in orders of T over U. And there are off-diagonal terms which correspond to at order epsilon squared, call epsilon T over U. At order epsilon squared, there are all these off-diagonal plaquette moves which involve two hoppings, hopping out of the ground state space and back in. But there are also diagonal corrections which correspond to an edge hopping away from itself and back onto itself. And that's what I mean by renormalization. That is, the diagonal value in the perturbation expansion will be its initial on-site potential plus something of order epsilon squared, which is, it's basically a kinetic term. If the particle can hop away and come back, it's less localized, so its kinetic energy is lower than if it was.
So you're just taking the whole hopping term as the interacting Hamiltonian. You're saying you're just taking the diagonal piece of that, shoving that back in.
Well, we analyzed all the terms up to second order, okay, diagonal and off diagonal,
in that expansion.
Right. And then what I'm saying is, we at the end of the day. You see, most physical, microscopic physical theories are not topological, right? In other words, the energy of the configuration depends on some details, not just isotopy classes. So in order to engineer the values of the parameters in the theory, in the model, so as to get something topological, we have to sort of solve the equation that after we readjust in the perturbation expansion, the diagonal values, they should all be equal. And we can't achieve that just by saying they're all equal to begin with, because they'll be perturbed by different hoppings. And these different hoppings are necessary in order to... the hopping terms are necessary to produce the Kivelson-Rockshar terms. I mean, let me put this up and write something on the board. Okay. Let me do something very concrete and simple. Okay. I'm not sure what the angles are. Okay, so suppose we have a rhombus in the picture like this. Then I want to think of the situation where the occupation is here and here versus here and here, and everything else in the picture is fixed. So let me first begin where the occupation is on the dotted lines, okay? So this will have some kind of Kivelson-Rockshar potential, which is, I'll call it VXX, or V black black, meaning, I hope it's all right that my chalk is white and I'll call it black, I'll dualize. And now, after the hopping has occurred, one particle's on red and one particle's on black. So the we'll have a different Kivelson-Rockshar term, the black red. Now, the amplitude for this hopping will be something like, well, there'll be a hopping term that takes you from black to red across black. So we'll write that T black, red, cross black, times black, black, across black. And there'll be a 2 in front of here because the hoppings could have occurred, that's a combinatorial factor, they could have occurred in either order. And it's a Hermitian matrix. So okay, so we'll have some projector like this. Just some term like this in the Hamiltonian, which, so the diagonal values were brought into the Hamiltonian by the Kivelson-Roxar terms, and these off-diagonal values came from the hopping terms in the Hamiltonian. Now what we'll have is an equation that this should be similar to the matrix D minus 1 minus 1 1 over D. Why should it be similar to this matrix? Because this is the projector. Notice that this matrix annihilates this vector. Oh, minus 1s, thank you. Okay. Okay, this matrix is, it's a scalar times the projector, and this is the thing that it annihilates. Now, why do we want to annihilate this vector? This is because of the importance of D in the setup. That is, when the particle, so the lower, you know, this is like psi 0, psi 1, psi 0, psi 1. The psi 0 state, these are classical states now, the psi 0 state is when the particle is on this side, the particles are on these two sides, and then the two dimers, when put together, make a picture that looks like this. And I'm neglecting the alternate coloring, okay? That's psi 0. Psi 1, when the particles have hopped like this, looks like this. Okay? So what we know is that we want do I have that right? Psi 0 and psi 1. So we know that we want psi 1 to have a coefficient which is d times psi 0 because that's our loop value. So that means we want the Hamiltonian, the thing that I wrote down and projected at the very beginning, we want the Hamiltonian to consist of a sum of terms, all of which are projectors between on pairs of configurations which encode the information that the loop value is D. So another situation, so this is what we call type 1, and it leads to this equation. There are basically four types of plaquettes according to the red black pattern. So what we've just seen is this plaquette. And this is type 1. And it leads to an equation between the potentials, the Kivelson-Roxar potentials, and the hopping terms, which is encoded by the saying that this similarity. Type 2 plaquette looks like this. The four outer sides are black, but there's a red diagonal. Remember when I was playing with the demonstration, I said when there is a red diagonal, there was a black dot there, you were allowed to click it and make it hop. And that's because the picture just changes by isotopy. It goes zigzag and then changes to zag-zig. So that means that whatever matrix this corresponds to should be similar to the matrix 1, minus 1, minus 1, 1, which is the isotopy relation. This is the projector. This projects the vector 1, 1 out. which says that the before and after configuration for that hop should have equal coefficient. And now we can write down this matrix. This matrix is V black black, V black black, because that didn't change when the hopping occurred. And now the off-diagonal thing is minus 2 T black black across red, minus 2 T squared, because there are two of them. So we get some equations like this, okay? And then the last, type 3 is when there are no reds in sight. This is a type 3 plaquette. And we don't want this to ever operate. We don't want this process to occur because that would put us into the Z2 theory, which we're trying to avoid. So that means we have to set this hopping, T black black across black equal to 0. And that kills this process. So these are hypotheses or inputs on the physical model. And then I made a transparency of what the equations were. Let's see if I have it here. Let me try to say what that is. So if you look at the various plaquettes that occur, I didn't list type 4. Type 4 is the special plaquette that occurs, the purple plaquettes, the plaquettes that occur where you actually break the crystal. That's sort of has a special local chemistry which is different from the others. So what I've done in this notation is the various T's that occur, the various hopping terms are either epsilon or C0 epsilon or C1 epsilon. So there are three types of T's that occur. And then when you just read off from the matrices that are unfortunately now behind the screen, if you just read off the equations implied by those similarity conditions, you get some equations that relate the hopping terms to the potential terms, and here are some solutions. Now, the way I think of this is we have this model with a large number of parameters possible. I mean, that's the Hubbard model inside the triangular lattice. And this is saying there's some high codimension set of solutions. There are a lot of equations, and that's definitely...
X is black,
I'm sorry, yeah. So there's some high codimension locus, which is solutions to this model. And of course, the hope is that because the model should have a topological character, that it has a gap, and that there's actually an open set around this space of solutions. So one expects that that there's a stable topological phase, and that we've identified a single point inside it by solving these equations. And then the other models, I mentioned that there are like four variants we've been playing with. Some are bosonic and some are fermionic. They're all constructed similarly. I mean, the main difference with the fermionic model is the symmetries can lead to some cancellations of processes. So for instance, processes that we want to turn off can be destroyed by a symmetry as well as destroyed by setting some hopping term 0. So maybe I should allow a few minutes for questions and just sort of end it here. Thanks. Yeah.
So, other sort of attempts to think about lattice models of topological field theories might involve looking at what happens when you subdivide some lattice and demanding invariance under, you know, subdivision and so on.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, because, I mean...
Well, this does have this invariance. I mean, I know what you're thinking. Like, if you take... So what these models correspond to mathematically would be called the Turiyev-Virov models. Those are the ones that are doubles, okay, as opposed to the Reshetykin-Turiyev models, okay? The Turiyev-Virov models, you don't require any particular triangulation or cellulation. You just take some cellulation, and then you produce, by thinking about the surface cross I, that's the way you think about it, you produce some equivalence relation on labelings of the vertices, edges, and faces, and then these equivalence classes are the vectors in the underlying Hilbert space. Okay, so the Turiyev-Virov rules actually do lead to a combinatorial microscopic description of the TQFT, but from my point of view, it has the following defects. One is it requires labeled trivalent graphs, and it's not quite clear how to encode those as microscopic physics. You see, if you had a good way of doing that, then that would be a good jump-off point. I think the one important observation here is that for the SU2 theories, you can get away with loops alone, one manifolds. And there are many ways of thinking about how one manifolds might arise. They might arise as domain boundaries. They might arise as dimers, in the way I described, and these are all sort of familiar things in solid state physics. But like the original Turiyev-Virov model, this does have suitable invariance because it is, in the end, after you divide out by the Jones-Wenzel relations, describing a topological theory. So if you were working on the torus, it wouldn't matter whether you took a fine or a coarse triangulation, you'd get the same k plus 1 squared dimensional Hilbert space.
Well, it would have to be fine enough, at least, to have...
It would have to be k plus 1 by k plus 1, basically.
Right.
Yeah, but right. But this is always the case. If something is too coarse, it can't capture all the classes. And then once it's coarse enough, or fine enough, then it captures.
But that's something you need to somehow check here, that once it's fine enough, the Hilbert spaces you calculate are independent of the lattice?
Well, this is actually contained in the... this point is actually contained in the initial point about ergodicity, that these moves are sufficient to generate. So, you know, we have checked it. The good thing this is a physics rather than a math hall. I mean, we've checked it by computer. We haven't proved that it's ergodic, but, you know, we believe it to be. We think that's the least troublesome point of the theory.
Okay.
Yeah, basically, the triangular lattice role here is to be regular, so we don't have too many different local exceptions to build into the equations.
Uh-huh.
I mean, if you had an irregular lattice, there'd be more equations.
Oh, okay.
So it should be, the form is simplest when it's regular.
Uh-huh.
And then the second thing is you don't want it bipartite, because that would mean that the one manifolds would come oriented. And if they were oriented, then you wouldn't be able, for instance, to impose any of these relations, like the reconnection relation would have two cases, right? I mean, if the strands were oppositely oriented, you could reconnect, and if they were coherently, then you couldn't. So since you're trying to imitate a theory that by Roemer-Teller-Weil is encoded by unoriented arc diagrams, you want to make sure that your microscopics don't produce an additional symmetry, which then you have to get rid of somehow.
Wait, I thought you said your interval, your red edges do get oriented, because you could
have like the odd and even lattice.
Yeah, oh, I misinterpreted. I thought, see, there's, in that graph that you can, there's three kinds of vertices in that lattice.
In the...
triangular lattice.
Well, it's vertex transitive, so they're really all the same, but... are you saying there are three directions of edges?
I guess I'm picturing the reflection group
of
edges.
Okay, yeah.
Right, then you can just pick one of the triangles, label the edges A, B, and C.
Right.
It gives you a unique labeling of every, not edges, the vertices. It gives you a unique labeling of every vertex, A, B, or C.
Okay.
Right. I thought that's how you were getting the orientation of the red edges, and then I decide A is less than B is less than C. Sorry, maybe I didn't follow.
No, I think not. The point is, so orientation is something I want to avoid rather than create.
Yes.
So, so my comment was, if you have a bipartite graph,
yes,
then there's a natural way to orient any dimer.
Uh-huh. Oh, if you have, right.
If it's bipartite, there's a natural way to orient the dimer.
Okay.
Which is simply, you choose like one half of the bipartite thing to call it first.
Right, right.
And then you just go from first to second.
Okay.
And that orients the dimers.
Okay.
So what I'm saying is if you don't want the dimers to have an orientation, you better not start with a bipartite graph.
Okay.
Now, I guess it doesn't logically follow that if you start with a non-bipartite graph that there's no way to orient the edges.
Uh-huh.
But that's true in this case. In other words, these complexes do not know about any orientation.
Okay, all right. And when I put the blue in, does it agree with the red except in finite?
Yeah, that's the general picture. You should think of it, think of this as locally, so it's a compact perturbation on...
Okay. What's the game then? Who wins?
The computer game basically is you're handed a one manifold, and you have to click on the dots to make it go away, you know, to turn it back into the crystal.
Oh, I see.
You know, so the computer gives you an initial condition that's equal to the red near infinity. Uh-huh. It's an excitation, if you like, of the red crystal, and you're supposed to click, click, click until it's back to the red crystal. And now, basically, what we know is that if the circles are kind of fat, in a gross sense, then you can just shrink them in and get rid of them. But if they're very skinny, if they're like near a tree, then you have to sometimes push them out a little bit before you can shrink them. Now, how do you know this? You just look at the computer display and you find out that there are no little black dots to click on inside.
Uh-huh.
So you have to click on an outside. You know, there's no move available on the inside. So this means that you have to go uphill somehow. You have to have more disrupted edges before you can get less. And then it's actually not very hard to make nested families where you have it like a bullseye pattern of trees. And now, in order to get space to move this one out, you have to move the next one out. But you have to move it out in a kind of a cone. You have to move. You have to make two moves on this one before one move can be made on the first one. So you can easily make an example. Given an N, you can make an example where you have to climb a hill of height N before you can go down. So this kind of disrupts the easiest inductive arguments.
I see.
And I can see that the computer combinatorial argument...
Oh, I see what you're saying, yeah.
Isn't there some easy general position argument that you then have to make PL, so to speak?
Yeah, it's the making PL. So you know, we know a rough strategy that wins, it seems to. But this, is, I think, is like knowing the rough strategy. Like, suppose you're playing white and black has his queen taken off at the beginning in chess, and now you have a rough strategy for winning. You don't do anything stupid and you exchange, right? So this is kind of the level on which we know how to win this game. Is what we do is we take... well, maybe it does screw up somewhere, but we don't know. But what we do is we take the picture and we kind of try to fluff it out. So if you could rescale homothetically, that would be good, because it's these tight tree-like things.
Homothetically in one direction.
Well, you see, the homothetically doesn't actually work, because when you have an alternating red-blue thing, you could never, for example, have a straight line that was very long. It always has to zigzag. So quite clearly, the tenfold expansion of your picture is not a legitimate picture. So already there's a quibble. You could say, okay, but I didn't mean that. I meant take the tenfold expansion and then make the closest little admissible thing to it. And then it starts degenerating from there, you know. Exactly what you mean by a good and a bad wrinkle. But I think the rough strategy is you stretch it out. And actually the way we tried to stretch it out is actually paying attention to two directions separately. Like instead of trying to multiply it by that multiple of the identity, we kind of tried to first stretch the x-axis and then stretch something 60 degrees to it or something like that. In two different stretches, and maybe that'll work. But you know, there are things. You know, there are lots of things that are undecidable that are of the form. You have some set of combinatorial rules, and you want to know whether you can keep playing or something like that. Like these Wang tiles. They're square tiles with some alphabet that you write on the edges, and you put them in the plane, and you have to match the letters. And you know, it's known that you don't have to make very elaborate rules before it becomes undecidable. In fact, there are specific rule sets which are known to be independent of the axioms that are not long.
Is this Dimitar working on this problem? I mean,
at first I suggested that he try to prove this,
yeah.
And he kind of got discouraged, and then I said, well, maybe you could write a simulation, and then he really got into it.
Uh-huh.
So, because there, you know, he could have an output and make progress, and people enjoyed it, and the other, he just said, well, you know, I thought about it, and it seems hard.
He has the program, so he can play around with it and see what happens.
Yeah, I mean, he'd be in a good place to kind of find a counterexample. And actually, we need, you know, N generalizations of these statements, because there are lots of different little red patterns, you know, like the rotated one, it's a separate question.
Mm-hmm.
And then, actually, this ergodicity is not exactly the correct question physically, anyway, because it wouldn't really be that important if there was some cryptic counterexample that wasn't related, but it actually would be important if it would be bad, even if the graph of configurations, edges being the vertices being configuration, edges being moved, even if that's a connected graph, if it had very small, very large lowest eigenvalue, that would be something. That would be just as bad as being disconnected. You know, suppose there were two populations and they were connected by, two big populations connected by a very fine thread, you know, and all configurations had to pass through this thread, well, then it just wouldn't happen physically. So that's another reason for not getting, you know, too focused on this combinatorial question, just because it's, this typically happens, I think, in physics, is that it spins out these mathematical questions, which are very interesting, but then in the end are not the exact right question.
So this is pi 0 versus
lambda 1.
There's a big, is there a topological notion like some controlled.
Well, no, but it's the spectral gap. It's a very important notion in...
But can you...
It's not quite topological. It's.
I know, but can't you make some kind of a quantified...
Well, you know, the name associated with this is Cheeger. You know, this is called there's something called the Cheeger constant. So it's very geometric, it's not quite topological. The Cheeger constant is you take the space, the graph, say, and you divide it into two pieces, and you try to extremize the frontier divided by the size of the smaller of the two pieces. Does that make sense? So in other words, you look at how many, you could say edges, but you could also think just in Riemannian geometry, is you cut the thing into two volumes. So you have A and volume A and B and surface area S. And what you're trying to do is, find the cut which has the smallest surface area divided by the volume of the smaller side. So it's this neck picture. You're trying to find the worst cut. And then there's some inequality that says that the first eigenvalue of a Laplacian is related to this Cheeger constant, and it's square. It's between the Cheeger constant and its square.
Cheeger constant's the relation, the ratio of those two.
It's the surface area to volume thing. And actually, it's easy to reconstruct what the inequalities are because the two extreme examples are the line and the tree. So if you just take a three-valent tree and think about what its eigenvalues are and what the Cheeger constant is when you cut at a point, one of those you get I think that's the linear one, and then you get the quadratic relation when you consider the line, because then it's the spectrum of the interval that comes in, and that's squares of integers, because, you know, the eigenfunctions are sine nx. You get n squared out when you differentiate twice.
I also didn't quite understand what the dots were encoding in the game.
Oh, the little dots, the black dots, I was having so much
basic
trouble.
Moves you
have. Yeah.
The dots were either.
Yeah. Yeah. No, the dots are very important, but only from a psychological point of view. The dots help you see what's allowed.
Yeah.
Then you can exercise your judgment whether you want to take it or not. But if you don't have the dots, then you spend most of your effort trying to figure out whether the move is allowed.
And I couldn't decide from the programming point of view, is it a local picture to decide whether you put a dot or not?
Oh yeah. Yeah, it's quite local. It's just those rhombi that I was drawing. There are four rhombi or something, and they all have dots on them, except for that red one. Oh, you mean the long versus short or something? Yeah, so I think the way the dot is represented is if there's a rhombus like this, then Dimitar put a dot right there. So he should have put a bigger one. Should have put one about that big. For people who are older and whose hands shake. But anyway, if you click on this dot, then it depends. It's just a Z2 toggle. So it depends which configuration it's in. This dot will appear if either this is blue and this is blue, or this is blue and this is blue. If any other situation occurs, like for instance, it might be that none of these edges are blue. You know, the blue edges might be out here. If none of these edges are blue, I guess it may be one of them has to be.
It's just a very local.
Yeah. If these two are blue or these two are blue, the dot will appear. And if you click on the dot, then it'll flip it to the other two blue case.
Just looks at the rhombus.
They all just look at the rhombus. And this one here has a dot here. If, you know, these two are blue, or if these two are blue.
Okay.
and then you click the dot, it'll flip. And a rectangle, a rhombus like this that has no red edge will never have a dot on it.
But then there was one more case.
Well, so it depends on, yeah, so the program that I have is for the unperturbed, the undefected red lattice where there's this bow tie. Well, yeah, let's see, so how does the bow tie look? So the bow tie, forgot, 8, 1, 2, anyway, that's not quite right combinatorially, but there's some octagon, right? Yeah, this bow tie, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. So in the bow tie, half of them are red?
Wasn't it this? I mean, it really was a bow tie.
Okay.
Normally.
Yeah.
These are, was like this somehow?
Yeah, roughly like, yeah, that's, I kind of drew that same, more or less the same thing, though maybe. Where did the little red thing go? Oh, here's the red thing. So they alternate red and black.
Yeah.
Okay. So in the original crystal, in the unperturbed thing, there are no moves at all. I mean, if you just take a look.
When the blue is on the red,
then you can't have two blue out here because the blue is on the red. You can't have, the blue is on the red, so you can't have a blue here, so there's only one blue on the boundary. So in the original crystal, you're stuck. That's unconnected to the other states. Now, it turns out that the only need for the bow tie move is to kill a circle,
okay,
or create a circle. It turns out that if you have, here's an empirical ergodicity fact, which we believe just as much as the other, is if you fix a nesting configuration, so you have like 20 circles and they're nested according to a certain pattern, then you don't need the bow tie move. In other words, you just need one and two, oh, and you can get between any two configurations of 20 circles with that nesting pattern, by just one and two moves.
Oh, okay.
The only time you need a bow tie move is if you decide to go from 20 to 19 circles, you'd have to have a way of eliminating a circle.
Okay.
So if you click on this, what it'll do is it'll give you a 1/8 rotation. So if the particles were all sitting on the red edges to begin with, now they'll all move over 1/8. So now they'll lie here.
Which is the edge is the one that's.
So they'll lie on the black edges now and form the.
Where are the dots?
Well, say to begin with, we're in the crystalline state.
Right, but I mean, where is the computer showing?
I think it puts a dot in the middle of the bow tie.
Oh, okay.
But is that a move that you can do anytime you want or not?
Well, so in the model, in the Hubbard model, the one that doesn't have a ring, so the one I was trying to explain at the end, what we do is we assume that the, that red background dimerization is not just a mathematical fiction. It kind of textures the material. It's like the hyperbolic geometry. And in the model, that's simplest, that just has the Hubbard terms, we should rotate occasionally. Okay. So this is what the background should look like. It shouldn't be the periodic red pattern, but every 100 by 100, it should be like you click the computer once.
And after that, you just do 1, 2.
No, after that you do 1, 2, and then these special bygone moves that occur. These special, rhombus moves. You see, after this, we call this a defect in the red pattern. Mm-hmm. When this defect is present, then there are two rhombi that have opposite red edges, mm-hmm. which wasn't true before. Mm-hmm. The defect creates that. Mm-hmm. And now there's a separate move, which is a two-step ring. That is, instead of a four-step, that is, if a particle is on this red and this red, mm-hmm. then we consider the move where this one hops there and that one hops there.
Oh, I see.
And now you see that's of the same type as all the other moves. It has a 2x2 matrix where the off-diagonal entries are order epsilon squared because each of these hopping terms is order epsilon.
Okay. Oh, but previously you were only moving the blue stuff. Now you're moving the red.
No, this is, no, because if you, this would be red. Each one of these red lines would also be blue if we start with the initial pattern that the particles occupy the red. To the red is the background pattern.
So there's a blue here.
You think of every red line as also there. Blue.
Oh, and the blue there? I thought we already clicked, so this became red.
No.
We click and the blues move to here.
Oh, the blues move. Okay.
Yeah, into that state. Yeah, not on the red.
Yeah. Peter, if we just took the original pattern and clicked, the reds never move when you click. They only move the blue. So what we did is something different than a click, is we changed the crystal, the red crystal, by we put in a defect in it, so as to get some...
I see, but the original configuration of blue is still sitting on the red now.
Yes, let's say.
Therefore you have this extra... But this is the standard move, isn't it?
No, it's not really standard because the color pattern is different. So since the color pattern is different, we're at liberty to define some new constants in the model. Mm. You see, we can now have a V sub RR.
But isn't this the move that you didn't want because of this? Isn't this Rademeister 2, like the top move there? If you switch to blue to these two without knowing.
No. It's beautiful because it stays local. You see, if the particles lie on the red, mm-hmm. and you switch, then you're only joining two small circles because those are bygones, right? Mm-hmm. If the particles lie on the black sides, mm-hmm. then you know the size of the circle, it's length 4. It's not going some long place.
Okay.
So, but you're right, in general, I mean, there is a risk, and the risky situation occurs in these all-black rhombi. So if you look at a rhombus where all five edges are black, mm-hmm. including the diagonal, mm-hmm. it's easy to visualize through there two different red-blue strands. Two unrelated red-blue strands come through, and they share opposite sides of that rhombus. And if you did that switch, you'd fall into Z2, the Z2 theory. So that one has to be turned off by saying that some tunneling number is 0.